This is my fourth or fifth time with you, I think. I fell in love with the Cape when I spent a sabbatical down here at my brother's house. And I've preached several times since then. I've come to enjoy this congregation, your warmth, your hospitality, and the beauty of your sanctuary. A mountain is not a miracle. At least we wouldn't call it a miracle today. A mountain is a pile of rock that has been thrust into the air by a series of geological movements that we think we pretty much understand. Eventually, soil forms, plants and trees grow from it. So a mountain is really rather like a large biology project. Beautiful, complex, intricate, but also understandable. That is what we believe. But Native Americans and folks in other parts of the world used to endow some of their mountains with qualities of the sacred. Some mountains, Mount Washington, for instance, was once considered off limits to human beings because they were thought to be holy places. In fact, Darby Fields, who was the first European to climb Mount Washington, had to find two Native Americans who were on the outs with the tribe to take him to the top because nobody else would. Rivers, lakes, mountains, the sea, sacred groves in Britain, Scotland, and Wales were thought to be the miraculous dwelling places of the spirit. A chance encounter between friends is not a miracle. If two old friends meet unexpectedly, or if two strangers find each other and a sustaining friendship develops or deepens over the years, we would say that was one of those fortunate random events that make up many lives. Random, we would say, as in haphazard. These are accidental events we tell each other. Nothing governs them but statistical probability. And when such a random meeting, when in that meeting one or two people find a missing part of their lives, something they have been looking for, desperately needing to find, a reassurance perhaps, or an insight, then the experience does seem very close to miraculous. A long-term sustaining relationship is not a miracle. It's not a violation of the laws of nature. Anthropologists can tell us why human beings seem to bond with each other. And psychologists have written whole libraries full of books telling us how to do it. Anyone who chooses may be well schooled in the science of relationships. And yet, when a long-term relationship continues to work well for both people, despite the occasional frictions, misunderstandings, dark moods, and retreats into privacy, despite all of the changes in the lives of two people, the inevitable temptations, the equally inevitable fatigue on both people, when such relationships continue to work and work well, then such a bond seems almost miraculous. A work of music is not a miracle. A talented musician can put notes together in ways that form a tune or a complex of tunes, some of which may even become a symphony. I can't do it, but some people can. And what they do is not something we would normally call miraculous. But the tune or the words that catch and hold and express some vital, non-verbal part of our lives together seems almost miraculous because of the power of this gift to help us become better and at least more honest than we often are. And Mozart said of his music, and William Blake said of some of his poems, seem to have come from somewhere beyond their conscious creating. They were not claiming that their work was superior to that of other composers, although they may have thought that sometimes. But they were saying that they cannot, could not, and don't expect to be able to locate the source of their skill within themselves. It seemed almost miraculous. But why talk about miracles now? For many people in the world, miracles were thought possible once, but that world began to quiver and shake, and when Darwin's theories of evolution were gaining favor in intellectual circles, if God did not create the world and everything in it, instead, all living things evolved through a process of trial and error, a series of random, fortunate, and unfortunate encounters, then many people thought there was no place for the miraculous. Life, including human life, was one big biology project and nothing more. By the turn of the century, faith in the miraculous goodness of life had begun to fade, like the Cheshire Cat in Lewis Carroll's story of Alice. Once it was there, then it was only vaguely there, and then there was only the hint of a smile, and then nothing at all. Many people then ask, well, what shall we do? What is there to hope for if the old religious stories and the assurance they gave us are not completely true? And they decided, well, we're going to figure it out for ourselves. We're going to put our shoulders to the wheel. We're going to learn the laws of the universe and make them work for us. We may no longer have the miraculous God of miracles, but we have human intelligence, and we will make our own miracles in science, technology, medicine, art, law, and diplomacy. We will need wed religion to science and philosophy so that religion will no longer need that old, tottering, cranky God of miracles anymore. Religion, science, and philosophy will be the engines of human progress. That's what they said. Why talk about miracles now? Well, we're beginning to discover that when all things have been properly examined and explained, and when we have been adequately instructed, there are quite a few areas of our spiritual experiences that are left uncovered, unexplained, undiagnosed, and mysterious. While we do understand many things, what remains mysterious is what gives us the hopefulness to live well. Here are some questions we still can't answer. From whence comes the power of goodness and caring when it passes from one person to another? Why does this power have sometimes the ability to heal and upon occasion even physically heal another person? We understand a lot of things. We understand evil, all right. We have all kinds of ways to explain human cruelty. Nothing really explains the sacrificial care and concern of one person for others. And how that can be transforming for all. We do not understand community. We have all kinds of theories about why groups work or do not work. We have filled rooms with texts on group psychology and motivation. We don't understand what lies behind the cohesion of a group that accomplishes something far beyond anything they could have ever dreamed of accomplishing. What put them together? What gave them that sense of spirit? What gave them that sort of intuitive feeling for each other? We don't know. We do not understand courage. We can understand cowardice well enough. We've all been there. And we can understand the adrenaline that enables people to run into burning buildings to rescue trapped victims. What we do not understand is the prompting of conscience, that moment when an individual is confronted with a burning bush, metaphorically, with a burning bush and a prompting to do something that is very hard to do and also very dangerous. And no one else knows this has happened. No one would fault us for remaining on the safe side of things. We do not understand what prompts people to risk or physical safety or psychological safety in order to do what they feel is right. We do not understand chance encounters that seem just what we needed at that time. We do not understand what is happening to us when we feel we have been spoken to, but there was no voice to be heard and no other person present to be speaking. We do not understand what speaks to us out of our favorite music or art or poetry. We do not understand what pulls us to the mountains or to the sea or to the woods or the lake shore. To be sure, there is a desire for peace and quiet or recreation, but often there seems to be something ineffable, something elusively more. Many summers ago, Nancy and I had the good fortune to be at the base camp of Mount Rainier near Seattle on one of the few indisputably sunny days they had that summer. The trails that go up into the Rainier rise from that base camp, and it rises across beautiful open meadows. So it was easy to watch what seemed to be an endless procession of pilgrims who were heading into the high country. Some were out for exercise, some were out for some sort of family fun or fun with their friends, but many were there to experience something like what the Northwest Native Americans experienced from that mountain, a sense of the miraculous. An encounter with what? A presence? No, not a presence. Not so much of a presence as a calming, healing mystery. There are a number of things we don't understand and probably never will. Much of what we don't understand after years of rigorous investigation is what encourages, supports, and sustains us in this life. The real source of nature's strength, as well as our own, is still shrouded in mystery. A mystery that even the most rigorous science cannot yet unfold. And because we have a tendency to dismiss what we do not easily understand, we fail to see the miraculous happening all around us. We have been taught that there are no miracles, and yet miracles of chance, miracles of serendipity, miracles of love, and unseen strength are all that keep us going sometimes. Those who wrote the biblical scriptures were well aware of the mysteries that sustain all life. The mysteries of life were not something that galled them or frustrated them, not having to resolve or even explain the chances of goodness, chance events of goodness or strength in their lives. They simply loved the mystery and wrote of it in the most extravagant terms. When Moses was pleading with Pharaoh, did he actually throw down a walking stick and turn it into a snake? Well, what actually did happen, I think, was that the leader of a group of slaves confronted the ruler of a mighty nation and demanded freedom. That sort of courage was miraculous enough. Why not explain it in miraculous language? So they did. Did the Red Sea part to let the fleeing slaves escape through, and then the sea closed over their Egyptian pursuers? Perhaps what actually did happen was that a group of people who had become too comfortable in groveling captivity willingly accepted the risks and burdens of freedom in order to gain a new dignity. That was a miracle. Why not tell the story in miraculous language? Did Jesus actually feed 5,000 people with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, as we heard in the reading? Every time they hear a story, many people have the impression that Jesus just sort of waved his hand over 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, and he created a veritable super stop and shop of bread and fish. We think there must have been fish flopping all over the place. But what the actual text says is that there were never more than 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Jesus broke them and distributed them to the crowd, and the text reports, and this is the end of the story, the text reports they all ate and were satisfied. The actual point of the story may be that the quality of Jesus being present in some way to each of those people, distributing small bits of food to each of them, that was enough to make them feel full. Did Jesus turn water into wine at a wedding? How could he have done that? Or was the experience of being in his presence such that it made the water taste like wine? Looking at the scriptures in a no-nonsense way, we often tend to seek scientific certainties. Did the Red Sea part for the fleeing Hebrews, or didn't it? Volumes of articles have been written to test the literal truthfulness of this story, demonstrating that properly translated, it wasn't the Red Sea at all, but the Reed Sea. In other words, it was a swamp that stood in the way, a swamp that the Israelites could easily pass through on foot, but that the Egyptians, who were encumbered with heavy chariots, got bogged down in. But is what really happened actually the point? The authors of scripture attempted to describe a world which they saw as surrounded by loving mystery. This is the mystery that encourages people to risk everything for freedom. This is a mystery that empowers people to embody, or to very nearly embody, the best that is possible in human nature. A mystery that knits people together, sometimes even despite their own selfish and fearful designs. Probably the skeptical attitude that most of us have been trained with is necessary in some ways, but it is not the only possible lens through which we can understand our lives, nor is it by any stretch of the imagination the best lens we have for understanding what makes life worth it. When we view life with a little more poetic imagination, we can expect that sometimes miracles will happen and be happy when they do. Well, I know, as a pastor, I know that some of us have prayed for miracle cures and they did not happen. I'm not talking about big miracles, like a spontaneous cure for a dread disease. I'm talking about little mysteries of connection between people, inspiration from unexpected sources, courage in those from whom we least expect it, new and unexpected possibilities that open for us just when we have quit looking for anything. I'm talking about a sense of acceptance that comes from somewhere, that comes to us when we have lost confidence, all conscious self-confidence. If we don't expect that these little miracles can happen, we will never notice when they do happen. Living entirely in a skeptical mode is like turning off your internet and then wondering resentfully why you are not receiving any email. Recently, I saw an article in the Boston Globe which related that Stephen Hawking's ashes had been interred in Westminster Abbey between those of Sir Isaac Newton and Charles Darwin. This was followed by a service of thanksgiving for Hawking's life that was attended by over 1,000 people. Apparently, someone had asked the dean of Westminster Abbey, who decides such things as who gets buried in Westminster Abbey, why one of the world's most renowned atheists, as Hawkins was buried in the Church of England's home parish. The response of the Reverend John R. Hall was, whether a person believes in God or not, if someone is achieving extraordinary things, I believe God is in that process. And so do I. Amen.